Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Constructive Criticism Network. This network is here to help you improve at Magic the Gathering at every level. From Pauper Leagues to Top 1000 Mythic, we've got you covered. If you want to hear the entire network, head on over to our sponsor at PureMTGO.com, where you can hear each and every show, each and every week, and check out their sponsor, MTGO Traders, and tell them that the CCMTG Network sent you. Now sit back, enjoy the show. From YouTube, podcasts, and more, here's this week's episode from ConstructiveCriticism.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 313th episode of Constructed Criticism. I'm your host, Mason, and I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Kling.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I just got back earlier today from SCG Richmond. I'm so tired. I actually took a nap, and I woke up. It was like that weird twilight hour at 6, and all I saw was 6 on the clock. I'm like, did I sleep through everything? But it's all good. I just got a couple hours, so.
Whew. It's always an interesting experience when you wake up and don't know whether it's AM or PM.
Yeah, and you got like that haze for a second. You're like, oh, do I need to like jump out of bed, or do I need to just hang for a second? Where are we at? Yeah, so today we're going to be talking about the PTs that happened this last weekend and the coming PT that Matt's going to play in. It's a weird experience because, you know, I was actually talking to former co-host Seth Manfield about this at the Open, where it's like we have so much data and PTs inform metagames so much, but now it's informing a PT metagame, which is like, yo, dog, I heard you're like shoes like shoes type thing, you know, like it goes pretty deep in the levels and there's just so much information. So we're going to talk about all of that and we're going to go over all that in just 1 minute. But Kling, if you needed cards for the Pro Tour, you could go to Oasis Games and use code CCMTG to get 4% off your order and use code Would That Be Good to get 15% off your first order. Oasis Games sponsors the show. And I think actually if you were to order at the time which we were recording, you would get them in time for Phoenix because y'all would send them out really quickly.
That's true. Well, I mean, we'll send basically every order out, you know, same day unless it's after a certain time of the day.
Yeah,
like basically after the mail gets picked up.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, not only could I do that, but I'm definitely going to go to Oasis for my players tour needs.
Wow, that's awesome. I'm so glad that they're able to help you and do that. And then, you know, the listeners here. I actually ordered Blue-Black Inverter from them last week, and I'm playing an IQ this weekend, probably playing Inverter. And so, you know, easy. Got the cards already ready to battle. But before we talk about all the Pioneer action, we have to talk about the main purpose of the show, and that's always improving. If you're not getting better, you're getting worse. And Kling, how did you always improve this week?
I just played a ton of Pioneer. Basically, I've played every deck that top-8ed either of the Pro Tours, I think.
Okay.
In the last 4 days, so.
That's a lot of Pioneer.
Yeah. Yeah, I played plenty of Pioneer recently, so just trying to kind of, you know, lock down what deck I'm playing for the Players Tour. I've also been drafting still a fair amount, so.
Okay, awesome. All right, well, you know, normally I'd ask you to go more in-depth, but that's kind of the topic of the show.
Yeah,
so
we're going to get a little more in-depth on that.
Yeah, I'll make it about me now, if that's okay. You know, it's Marsha time. So my always improving moment this weekend, or this week, I guess I should say, came from this weekend. It was actually after SCG Richmond. I stayed on Sunday, obviously, as I told, getting back today on Monday. And we had some people stay in the house, like Dom and then VT Sile and like Nick Prince came over and Bob and Cheese. And these are people who play a lot of Modo. And we started talking about the Pro Tour stuff because they're all playing the Pro Tour. And then Allie started talking with us some, you know, because she has the Pro Tour next week as well for Phoenix. And we spent like 8 hours talking about Pioneer. And, you know, when you're talking with friends, sometimes you get derailed. So it was like 80% Pioneer. But it was the thing that was really helpful about all this, though, was getting to hear all these different thought processes from all these different players and the way they approach data and the way they reason through things. And a lot of the times I feel like we got to the exact same point. But the way they got from A to B, or I guess I should say from A to the finish line, was much different than how I got to A to B. And so getting to hear that thought process from them was really like, I want to say enlightening, but that sounds a little pretentious, but it's what it was, you know? It was like this new thing where, and I mentioned this in the podcast a long time ago, like talking with you and Hendrocker back in the day was a very similar way. And so getting, you know, to see how people think through things, I think is something that's really helpful for me in Magic, and it's something I can adopt to future decks, right? So.
Yeah, definitely. It's also nice when you see somebody that has a completely different train of thought and gets to the same conclusion that you did, because it usually means that that conclusion is pretty good.
Yeah. And it was also nice to see just how, like, their approach to things, like, okay, I mean, we're going to get this into a little bit, like, okay, if we all agree Inverter is the best deck, what is the evolution to beat Inverter? Like, what is the thing in which we react? And then their thought process of how that thing goes, and then also how they, like, consider that versus the other decks. Once again, got to similar conclusions near the ends, you know, a little differences here and there, but totally different, like, thought, like, ways of going through it. And it's kind of nice because now it's like, okay, like, I'm sure I could have figured that out if I spent a bunch of time being Socrates about ways to think about decks, but I don't. And now in the future, if I ever feel like maybe I'm wrong, I can kind of run it through this other, like, thought process, for lack of a better word, right? And so
yeah,
that was super helpful, and that's something that those kind of things are really helpful for to me. So, all right, do you just want to hop into this main topic? We have a lot of decks to talk about, and I kind of want to just spend time talking about them. I don't want to rush through, you know. I just want to go through each of these decks, and I feel like it would be not reasonable to not start with Inverter, since that was kind of the big thing going into the Pro Tours this weekend. I believe I put 5 into Nagoya, 1 into Brussels, and then didn't do so hot at the GPs going on those same weekend, and then it was all 4 decks in the top 4 of the SCG were Inverter. So, Matt, I want to ask you, what do you feel about Inverter right now?
I think it's a really good deck. If I weren't thinking that I'm going to play something else, that would probably be my second choice.
Okay. All right. So, I guess it might be actually good to talk about just what deck you're going to play there, and then we'll transition to it after we talk about Inverter here, just so people kind of know and can think about that in their frame of context. So, Matt, what deck are you playing? What's the big reveal? Like, as of right now.
I am very, very likely to play Bant Spirits at this point.
Okay.
Honestly, I've been winning with most of the decks that I've tried so far. Like, I think that the metagame is pretty in flux right now, so if you're just playing a good deck, you're going to do a lot of winning. I mean, obviously, it's not necessarily going to be like that at the Players Tour, but, like, on MTGO anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's been kind of hard to nail down which decks I think are better than others, but when I've been playing Spirits, the games have just felt easy.
Okay. Interesting. Well, I want to get to that. I guess let's just make this free-flowing, whatever. It's fine. So Spirits, you're playing that. Is there a reason particularly for Bant over Blue-White? My teammate at the Open actually this past weekend, Zyla, she played Blue-White Spirits. And going in on Monday when I heard she was going to play that, I wasn't super high on the idea, but I trusted her and Julian in the testing process. And I have not played like any of the new Pioneers since the bannings, the last set of them. So things could be different. Why right, yeah. The Coco over the Blue-White? Because, I mean, your mana takes a really big hit there, and the proactive decks in this format are very good at being proactive.
It honestly doesn't take a big hit. The real benefit to playing Blue-White is that you get Mutavault, which is definitely real. But I don't know. Honestly, I found the mana to be even a little bit worse in Blue-White because, like, Mutavault just doesn't really cast any spells, whereas, like, you know, Botanical Sanctum and Temple Garden actually cast blue and white spells.
Okay, sure.
Occasionally you'll have a tap land on turn 4, but like the only card that it's not casting at that point is Company, right? Whereas like,
yeah, well, I mean, you could have double spell as well.
Yeah. You could have double spell as well. It's true.
Yeah. I feel like there were a lot of lines where I was watching Zyla and it would be like 1-drop, 2-drop, either Spell Queller or Nimblegast Herald. And then we would double spell. And sometimes it would be even like play a Lord, hit you for a bunch, hold up a Rattle Chains for like a trick. Right.
Sure.
So
you're also playing a lot more 2-drops in the Blue-White variants, like because they're maxed out on Selfless Spirits and Rattle Chains and Brazen Borrowers.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a lot more likely to double spell on 4 than you are with the Bant list.
That's a good point. Is your Bant list playing Brazen Borrower? That was one of the things we were talking about where I was suggesting maybe we need to look towards Reflective Mage type stuff, since obviously Borrower is really, really good, but it is worse off Coco than a card like Reflective Mage. Is that something that you've put consideration and or are doing?
I'm currently playing Brazen Borrower, and the reason is because I think the flexibility is just really important. Like, obviously, you know, neither of them are spirits, so it's kind of a wash there. The flying theme of the deck is actually really powerful, though. First of all, Brazen Borrower gets pumped by the eagle.
Mm-hmm.
Although that's pretty minor, but just having flying in general is... It's
pretty close,
like,
to unblockable.
Spirits just basically wins every race, right? Like, you just, if you're getting raced, you just have the ability to decide how the combat happens every single turn. Like, okay, I can block you, but you can't block me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just getting to decide which creatures are blocking which creatures every single combat step is, it's really hard to overstate how important that is. Like,
that's fair.
Yeah. It's hard to lose a race where your opponent's not just going very, very wide.
Yeah. They really need to, like, kind of curve on you. Like, we definitely had a lot of, I've seen a lot of games where it's like Knight of the Ebon Legion into Scrap Heap Scrounger into, I believe it's Mayhem, not Mayhem Devil, the 4/4 flyer.
Spawn of Mayhem.
Spawn of Mayhem, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow, that seems unbeatable. And then it's like, well, like, not really. I mean, our things are, like, almost as big. And as soon as we go, like, Lord, we're, like, tap down your thing with a Nimble Ghast Herald, suddenly the race is just swung completely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Nimble Ghast Herald is also insane in any of the creature mirrors. Like, I was really underestimating that card until I got to play with it recently.
Yeah. I was helping Xylas leave her deck. I'm like, we have four of this? And she's like, oh, yeah, it's great. I'm like, all right, I can't wait to see it. And then it was, like, round one. It was, like, flash in, tap your thing, flash another wind in. You don't have a combat step, you die. So.
Yeah, I played a game against Mono Red recently with Spirits where I was on the draw, and my opponent played Soulscar Mage into Kairi Zev into... I think they might not have played anything on three, but then they played Torbrand on four. And then I Spellquellered it, and then they played another Torbrand. And I could have won that game at... If I started the game at four life, I could have won that game.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I just, like, didn't take any damage that I didn't want to for the whole game. I was like, all right,
well, so you're on Spirits, you're pretty high on it. I guess I'll just kind of frame things in the context as against Spirits. Spirits has a pretty good Inverta matchup. Does that matter a lot to you? Because in my opinion, I think Spirits, Sultai, and Inverta are the three best decks right now in Pioneer, or the best decks going into the next weekend. And I'm leaning towards playing Inverta in my event. But it's a big difference. I'm not going to have, like, the Pro Tour caliber, and I don't think I'm going to play a lot of mirrors. So, like, what has you not wanting to play Inverter? Because that deck is quite strong. I mean, it is just a good, like, light, like, mid-range, kind of like a bigger mid-range deck. It's kind of hard to call it a control deck. That just has a reasonable combo kill.
Yeah, I mean, Inverter is great. The problem that I have with playing Inverter is just that I think that it's going to have a target, and people are more aware of what the card or what the decks are that actually beat it. Like, it obviously had a target on its back going into these last Pro Tours, but, like, I mean, I know I didn't have any idea what beat it, and it didn't seem like a lot of people did either. Mm-hmm. But now we can pretty much see that, like, you know, Spirits has a pretty good matchup against Inverter. The Breach deck also has a good matchup against Inverter.
The Insol decks too.
Yeah, the Insol decks are reasonable there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they're playing, like, two Infernal Reckonings in their sideboard. They're, like, it seems like Inverter players are very scared of the Insol deck, so.
Right.
Yeah. All right, well, I guess that's reasonable. I think I almost wonder if the Inverter players are going to, like, cannibalize themselves. Like, something we were talking about was, what if we got rid of our Choked Estuaries and we played, like, an Urborg and an Ipanui Rivulet and maybe another one? Like, extra over what VTCLA played in the open. And that way you have, like, extra Ipnus in the mirror, so it's hard to go off. But then we were talking about that. It's like, wow, we are, like, going really hard on just the mirror match right now.
Sure. So, I mean, I considered some stuff like that myself. I did not get to Ipnu Rivulet. I mean, that's potentially good, but it doesn't work if they have a Jason play, right? So,
well, yeah, it doesn't work if they have a Jason play. But it also sometimes helps you combo off as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
I would be somewhat interested in having some kind of a draw spell that targets a player rather than myself, but I don't know that, like, there are any good ones.
There's one from it's not a good. Good is, like, a little extreme here. It's like Strategy Tactics or something like that. But basically, it's a Surge Divination, so it's normally four, but the Surge is three.
Uh huh.
So, you know, and it's instant speed. So that was a card that some people were talking about, or, like, you know, they have the Oracle in the stack. You, like, make them draw two.
Sure.
So,
yeah, I mean, I definitely would have lost to anything like that every time I played that deck. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you basically, it's so often that you're just going to cast, you know, Inverter with, like, one or two cards in your deck.
Yeah.
In your graveyard.
That was something that when I first saw the deck, I definitely was cognitive of, like, wow, like, these Delve spells are great because, A, they're insane. Like, Dig Through Time's just, like, one of the best cards in Pioneer, and we're seeing it with the Inverter deck, right? But, B, it also works so well with what you're trying to do. But, like, you really do just flip your deck over to, like, three or four cards, like, basically every time. It's kind of crazy how often it happens, because there is, like, a fail rate. Like, sometimes you just won't see your digs, but just the deck still just plays out that way.
Yeah, what's interesting is that I think that a lot of the draw spells in particular in the deck are actually the way that they are to try to avoid putting cards in the graveyard.
Mm-hmm.
like, obviously Dig Through Time is great for getting rid of cards that you don't want in your graveyard, but like games just don't usually go that long in my experience. So I mean, Omen of the Sea is better than, you know, something else that could be in that slot because it doesn't actually go into the graveyard.
Yeah. And then Omen has the backup Devotion clause, which is nice.
Sure. That comes up sometimes, but again, rarely. It comes up in the same exact scenario, right? Which is that you need your Thassa's Oracle to be greater than the number of cards in your deck, right?
Sure. So. Yeah. Well, I more meant that like when you're trying to get to the inverter, a lot of times like the play pattern I've seen is like you'll run out of Thassa's Oracle as like a Omen speaker, sure. Basically, yeah, yeah. And right. Having that extra pip can be quite nice there.
Sure. Yeah, that's definitely true. Yeah. So what I found it'd be interesting too when I'm playing the deck online is how many people think that it's a good idea to kill my Thassa's Oracle before I've played Inverter. Yeah. And it's actually just like almost the worst thing that you could do.
Yeah, because like if you do that, you set up the combo, right?
Yeah, you're just like trying to, you know, you just make me not have to work for it anymore. Like I'm just like, okay, Thassa's Oracle because, you know, I need the scry or whatever. And then, you know, my opponent will fatal push it or whatever, or lightning strike it. And then, you know, then I'm just free to play it on turn four, the Inverter on four.
Yeah, I think I was watching like Edgar play and he like ran out of Thassa's Oracle against like a Gruul deck or whatever. And the opponent like had to stop and think because it was like, if I attack with this Bone Crusher Giant, I'm going to definitely have that Thassa's Oracle die. And if he plays Inverter, I am like 50-50 to die on the next turn. If not, I'm 100 on the next turn. And so, like, yeah. He had to, like, stop and think, like, can I actually kill him if he has Inverter in hand, right? Like, because if not, he'll have to actually have a Thassa's Oracle. And so it was a very interesting subgame where it's, like, this creature basically is, you know, like, Stonehorn Dignitary or it's Omen Speaker when it right. comes to blocking. And it's a very cool interaction that happens with the deck. And I also think that's a real strong suit to the deck going into this first weekend here, right? Is the deck was very new. It kind of popped on the week before last. And now, like, those little play pattern things that, you know, you kind of have to learn them in the moment. And those can be really hard the first couple times, especially. So,
right.
Yep. Very interesting. I also think, I know we're going to talk about a lot of these decks here. I think it's important. What do you think like the format's like turning point? Like what do you think the average game ends in turns? You know what I mean? Like if you had to say like around the time the player plays their seventh mana naturally, you know what I mean? Like, what do you think? Cause I think that informs a lot of the decks you can pick and play.
It feels like a turn six format probably for the most part.
Yeah, I, it's funny. Someone said six and I was like, yeah, it's like six or seven. So that's interesting. You and I haven't talked about Pioneer basically at all since this last weekend. So that's
kind of reassuring
that we all come to the same place.
There are a lot of combo decks that just like actually function on turn six, right? Like the Inverter deck is like, I mean, you can go off earlier than that, but turn five is somewhat rare.
Yeah, turn five is kind of like your best case scenario, right? Like play Inverter, flip, Thassa's Oracle, you lose.
Right.
So,
And then you have like the Lotus Breach deck, which is pretty commonly turn six as well. I mean, you can go off on turn four to five with that deck as well, but it's more rare.
Yeah, let's talk about Lotus Breach because this is a deck that is, you know, showing off what looks to be like one of the strongest combo enabling cards from Theros. What is that deck really doing? I haven't got to see it in play a whole bunch. I know it's like using Chronic Flooding a little bit in order to fuel the graveyard sometimes. What do you think of the Lotus Breach?
So it's a little bit slow to set up. Like you're not really doing anything on the first few turns of with the deck. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to interact with. Like a lot of the hate just does not work as well as you would think it would because they have Fae of Wishes, and Fae of Wishes kind of just answers any piece of hate that you can bring in.
Yeah, they just have all the answers in the board or whatever.
Right.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, one of the answers that's been quite interesting is Ugin the Spirit Dragon, because it's not only just an answer sometimes to the problem permanence, but sometimes your opponent will just get you in a spot where you, like, can't win the game through regular means.
Sure, so you're just like, Wrath the God.
Just like, all right, well, I'm just going to get an Ugin and then try to ride this to victory.
Yeah, the old Lotus decks were doing that, the ones that were more about, like, omniscienceing.
Right.
So...
Yeah, this deck is less mana intensive than that one. Like, you don't need as much mana to go off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also just, like, it's a lot less soft counterspells. Like, I've definitely had a bunch of scenarios where I was able to just, like, bait out a counterspell with the first Underworld Breach and then just play another one and then, you know, Hidden Strings, and all of a sudden I just have 35 mana and all my cards in my deck.
All right. Well, that 35 mana, all the cards in my deck does sound appealing. Is this deck, like, a real player to you?
Yeah, I definitely think it's real. The way that you can really beat them is having just a little bit of disruption and a fast clock. I mean, honestly, just a fast clock is enough a lot. Like, I was having a lot of trouble beating the Izzet and Soul decks with Lotus Breach, mm-hmm. just because you don't interact. So hands where they had Shrapnel Blast, I usually lost.
Man, that's a mood.
Were you just experiencing that with a lot of decks?
Yeah, that's. I feel like every time I play against Insole, it's like, if they don't have... Oh, no, before I can even finish my thought, I'm dead. Like, I got Shrapnel Blasted again. Yeah, the Insole deck is, like, sort of reminiscent to, like, Infect in a weird way. Like, in its role in the format, kind of like Modern, where, like, Infect checks the combo decks really hard. So does Insole in this format. And Insole seems, like, pretty well positioned right now. Do you disagree?
So the reason I wouldn't play it is because I think that there are going to be a lot of good players playing the Sultai Delirium deck, and I don't think that's a particularly good matchup.
Sure, yeah, that one is particularly hard.
Right. I also don't love the mono black matchup either. Basically, decks where they're playing a bunch of one mana removal spells are pretty tough.
Sure, that's fair. When they're playing the best.
Inverter is not as much because, for one, like Shrapnel Blast actually has a lot of text against Jace. Like they have to win with Asa's Oracle most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Also, and their stubs do a lot in that matchup, right? Like, stops the Jace again and stops the interaction.
Right. I mean, are they running main deck stubs still? I haven't seen that happening.
I saw someone playing with some stubs, but I don't know if that was the stock thing.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah, post-board, it seems like they have a lot of the color hosing counter spells, like Mystical Disputes and Aether Gusts.
Yeah. Do you think Dispute is, like, close to main deckable in Inverter, by the way? Like, how do you feel about that?
I wouldn't.
Sure.
I was just curious. I think it's a potent sideboard card, but I think that there are, the metagame is diverse enough that you're going to play against just a card or decks that aren't blue enough.
That's fair. Speaking of something we kind of talked about a second ago that is kind of blue, that's Sultai. In the hands of Yoel Larson, one PT Brussels. What do you think of this deck? I mean, this is like kind of version 2.0 of week one Pioneer, right? Like week one, we saw Sultai good cards win, and now we're back to our first PT, and one of them is won by Sultai good cards.
Yeah. So this deck is pretty interesting. So basically, the game plan is to cast an Emrakul, the Promised End, and it turns out that Uro is the best way to stay alive until that happens.
Yeah.
Like, just gaining you 3 life and drawing a card every turn is the perfect way to bridge up to Emrakul.
Mm-hmm. And it works really well with a lot of the cards you want to play, right? Like, you kind of want a Wayfinder. You were down to play a Grizzly War Grapple with the Past, a Grizzly Salvage or Grapple with the Past. So... these cards,
yeah, plus those cards are also insane with Jace. Like, the amount of times that I've flipped a Jace on turn 3 with this deck is really high.
Yeah, we were actually talking about the deck, and we were like, should we be considering Grapple over Grizzly? And then we were like, oh, we have Jace in the deck. It's like, oh, yeah, we like to flip our Jaces pretty early.
Right, so. Yeah, I think that's the main reason. Because, I mean, I have had situations where, like, the Liliana and the Emrakul got milled, and it was kind of hard to figure out how to close the game. Mm-hmm. It's not like you can't win the game without the Emrakul, like, so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the end of the world, but it does make me consider playing something like Grapple the Past instead. But like you said, you know, being able to flip the Jaces on turn 3 is just, it's too important, I think.
How do you feel about the matchup with that deck versus some of the decks we've talked about? Like, with the Salt has, like, Spirits and Insole and Inverter. We mentioned how, like, you know, Insole's going to have a hard time against that kind of deck. This deck seems like, you know, it was very well-positioned week one. Everyone was talking about it, and then we all kind of said, all right, we can beat this deck if we want to. Back in that old metagame where things are a lot different, jump forward 3 months now and 17 bannings later, you know, what do you think about Sultai's position?
Yeah, I think it's okay. I don't love this deck positioning-wise right now. Mm-hmm. You certainly have the tools to beat everything, right? Like, if you draw the right half of your deck, you're going to be doing pretty well in most matchups. But it feels a little bit too scattershot for me. Like, if you draw the wrong half, it's going to be awkward in a lot of these matchups.
That's fair. Do you feel like Sultai has the ability to continuously adapt? Or do you think it's a thing where, like, we're kind of playing a lot of the best cards right now? Obviously, there's small iterations, and there's obviously stuff you could change in the sideboard. But this is a deck that kind of, like, will do really well in situations like this, get targeted a little bit, fade, and then come back. Or do you think this is just, like, kind of the new Jund for the format? Because I can tell you a lot of people starting on Friday were like, yo, did you see that the Sultai deck? That's sick. And everyone wanted to play it, you know? And
yeah,
it feels like that might just be that deck's fate.
Sure, yeah. I think that it doesn't have a lot of customization, only because, like, you know, the basic gist of it is you're playing really efficient cards like removal spells and Thoughtseize, right? And then other than that, just whatever the card advantage creatures you're trying to play are. So it's going to have the same basic game plan no matter what. But, I mean, obviously you can tech it slightly, you know, just in the numbers that you're playing of each thing. But it's not like, you know, one week we're like, oh, we're just not going to play Thoughtseize this week because Mono Red's popular. Like, that's just not a real thing.
Yeah. What do you think about Thoughtseize? I mean, this is the most leading question of all time. Matt Kling, what do you feel about Thoughtseize in the format? Because it's, like, the best thing to be doing, right? Like, a lot of these decks that we talk about are front runners are decks that are good against Thoughtseize, or as good as you can be, right? Like, Thoughtseize is pretty universally powerful, or Thoughtseize decks.
Yeah, I mean, I think Thoughtseize is the best card in the format, so.
Okay. Yeah, that's basically what I was curious if you felt that way as well. I think it's more of a fact.
It's also, you know, simultaneously my least favorite Magic card of all time. And I heard somebody on the coverage say that too, and it was just like, I was doing fist pumps.
You were like, you know what? I stand you, Riley Knight. I'm with you.
Exactly.
Oh, man. Riley Knight rocked my world when he brought up the 2/1 in mono black that has two shields and it can't block.
Yeah, I've heard that before a long time ago.
I never heard that, and I was literally in the airport, and I was shook. Like, I stepped on the plane, and I thought, I never thought of that before, and I'm not exaggerating. I stared at the scene in front of me for a minute and thought, how did that happen? Like, how did this get through to, like, the art design and everything?
We commission the art with where he's got two shields and can't block?
Yeah, they were like, we need a strong warrior, and they're like, you know what strong warriors have? Two shields! It just, I don't know, it shook me, and I had to bring it up somewhere. And I had the podcast, so this is my spot. But let's talk about that mono black deck, because that was a deck that was very popular before when we had Smuggler's Copter. Kind of fell back a little bit because, you know, the Oko stuff happened, and now we have this new format, new set. And that deck seems quite good against a lot of different archetypes. How are you feeling about mono black?
I mean, it's still clearly pretty powerful, but I don't think that it's the most powerful thing you can be doing anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, you're still playing really efficient creatures, removal spells, Thoughtseize, you know, kind of all the same things that Sultai Delirium's doing, except for a lot lower to the ground.
Yeah, you're like the aggressively slanted deck, right? Instead of like, yeah. I'm going to go over you inevitably with Emrakul, I'm going to get under you and then rankle you.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But I just don't think that, you know, a playset of Thoughtseize is just proven to not be enough to beat the combo decks right now, I think, mm-hmm. is the real problem. Like, especially, like, the mono-white devotion deck, which we'll get to shortly, it's really hard to keep them off of their combo indefinitely, right? Like, you can sort of break it up a couple of times, but they don't really need it, right? Like, you're going to have to eventually use your removal spells on things on board just to not lose the board. And then, you know, out of nowhere, you just get walking blisted.
That's fair. What do you feel about the Vampires deck? Have you looked at that much? That was a deck that I was like, okay, this is like, when I was thinking about it before, I was like, oh, this is like a different take on mono black. And then I was talking to Liz Lynn at the SCG, and she was telling me her approach to the deck and the way she's built it. And I was like, oh, it's like Jund. And she's like, yeah, it's a Jund deck, kind of, an aggressive Jund deck. What do you feel about that deck? Because that was one that I had kind of like, I probably lean on this other side, but that is a different approach to it, right? It's very good if you're playing these fair matchups.
They said that Jund was like Vampires? Or Vampires was like Jund?
It was more Jund-y than it was aggressively slanted. Like, having cards like the Dusk's Champion, the 5-mana 4/4, you draw cards and lose life equal to the number of Vampires you have, and having Dusk Legion Zealots, and having all these cantripping creatures that are also pretty proactive with your Vampires, and having Sorin as a way to, like, really grind. So you're more Jund-y than you are aggro-y and trying to, you know, like, go underneath them. And then post-board, you can have cards like one of Liz's big, like, things for the weekend is they had a bunch of Doomfalls in their sideboard as a way to, like, combat certain different type of decks, right? So, like, for example, against Inverter, something that happens a lot of times is Inverter, like, plays the Oracle. If you're a deck like that, you normally have to trade off against Oracle, like we talked about earlier, right? That push and pull. And then it's in the graveyard. Then they Inverter on 4. And then now they're, like, threatening to kill you. And Liz was like, well, you can Doomfall in the turns where you can, like, have time to do that, or you can Doomfall down the Inverter to push through damage. So it's, like, a different approach to the matchup. And it seemed pretty interesting. I got to watch some of Liz's game, and we played against Liz's team. And it seemed pretty reasonable. I don't know. I don't have a lot of experience with that deck, and I haven't played it a lot, so I don't know. And seen it played. I've only seen, like, maybe 3 or 4 rounds. So
sure. It makes some sense to play a remove or like a discard edict split card for that matchup specifically. Like, it is one of the few matchups where both of those modes might be relevant.
Mm-hmm.
But every time that I've looked at or played the Vampires deck, my thought on it was always that it was like a combo deck. Like, basically, a lot of these cards kind of suck by themselves. But if you get Sorin and Champion of Dusk together, it's just so powerful. And that's most of the games that I've lost to Vampires have been Sorin on three minus put in Champion of Dusk.
Yeah, I feel kind of that similar way before talking to Liz. And I'm doing a poor job explaining what Liz was saying. I can hear myself saying it, but I'm like kind of tired. And I've talked a lot of Pioneers, so I'm having a hard time like recalling it verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there was something to what she was saying. So you should definitely check out her Twitter and her stream and everything for that if that's something that interests you. But I think that the trick is Sorin plus the Dusk Champion is like Light Splinter Twin. You know what I mean? It's kind of like Heliod gain infinite life or whatever. It doesn't kill you, but now you gotta figure out a way to win or whatnot.
Right.
It like gets you really far ahead. And if I think actually just Sorin plus Vampires is just powerful. Like, Knight of the
Ebony. Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're playing Vampires, you know, Sorin is like one of the most powerful planeswalkers of all time.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so I think we forget about that a lot of times, that it does have a Splinter Twin aspect, but it's also just like, yo, ticking this thing up and making something plus one in lifelink is huge in that type of deck. And also the fact that you can, like, play a Dusk Legion Zealot, like, draw a card, and then have it kill, like, their three or their four drop. Like, they play a Bone Crusher Giant, and you get to trade your thing that replaced itself and maybe got a little damage in for their turn and swing the life while taking your Vampire, your Sorin up, is like, those kind of things are huge.
Yeah, it's like Dusk Legion Zealot is literally Lightning Helix draw card.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like, yeah, one less life off your Helix. It's like, oh,
sure,
all right.
Yeah, you get to be
in two. All right, whatever. You know, beats. We take those, I guess. But I think there's definitely something to that. I'm curious. It feels like to me that, you know, as long as Thoughtseize doesn't get banned, which I don't think it will, I just don't think it will, whatever. I think the Vampire deck will just get better and better, and eventually there'll become a time where that deck is, like, just the right deck to play. And so I'm curious for that kind of timeline. Speaking of something getting better and better and just the right time to play, Black-White Auras. Everyone's always talking about Black-White Auras. No, what is this deck, Matt? It just, like, came out of nowhere. It looks like someone bought a box, had a couple cards in their binder, and they were like, all right, Pro Tour time.
Yeah, so that was Ken Yukihiro that took second place at the APAC PT this weekend. And it looked like somebody else played it at that PT as well. But
yeah, I don't remember the name, but yeah, it looks like there were two players playing basically that exact same list.
Right. But yeah, I think this deck is a lot more real than it looks like it is. It actually has a lot going on. Yeah, it looks like a meme completely, but it actually, I mean, the fact that all of your one drops are enchantments, or a lot of them, I guess Favorite Hoplite's not, but like I the first time I played Hateful Eidolon on one and then put an Ethereal Armor on it, and then it was like, you know, it's already like a 3/3 or whatever, I was like, what is happening here? Why is it so big?
Yeah, Ethereal Armor and all that glitter just actually make your like turn three is insane, right? Like, there are a lot of times you just like kill people basically.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's gonna be impossible to race, like, and they also both have lifelink. Both of the enchantment creatures have lifelink already, so like you don't need Daybreak Cornet to try to like win those aggressive matchups, right? Like, basically if your opponent doesn't have Fatal Push, they just are never gonna kill your guy, and they're never gonna win any race.
Yeah. And
and then even if they do have Fatal Push, you have
Alseed.
Yeah, first of all, you have Alice Aid, which can save it. You also have Karamesh's Blessings, which can save it. You have, you get to draw cards even if it dies with the Hateful Eidolon. It's for each aura as well, so like it's not even like you're getting, I mean, yeah, it's like a one for one no matter what.
Yeah, the Hateful Eidolon is really strong in this deck.
Yeah, the Shram draws you all the cards for the auras as well, so you're still only getting one for one off of a removal spell. It's actually pretty potent.
Yeah, the deck seems like, you know, we joked about it at the start there, but that was like, we got down to go eat, and we're starting to talk about deck lists, and people are like, yo, this deck is real, right? Like, I'm not crazy. And everyone's like, I'm not, like, okay, it's not just me.
Like, you know what I mean? Right, yeah.
And so we all started talking about the deck, and like, is there anything we're missing? And like, Gatherer Searches, like, you know, like, this is a deck that seems quite strong. I don't know enough about it. Like, I haven't played with it, so I really don't want to comment on it. But my gut is that, like, yo, that deck is kind of real. Like, if you have most of those cards and you're missing just a couple pieces and you're wanting to buy it and you're looking to get validated on this podcast, go to oasisgames.com, babe, and pick them up. Like,
yeah, no, this deck is definitely real. I expect it to be there in some numbers in Phoenix, definitely. Yeah. It's also sweet that, like, the Apostle of Purifying Lights in the sideboard are kind of like the answer to the thing that your deck is kind of weak against in the first place, right? Like, if your opponent's playing a bunch of efficient black removal, you can just bring in these apostles and they just can never kill it. And then you can just suit it up with all your enchantments. The thing that I actually found the hardest was playing white mirrors with this deck. Mm-hmm. Because, like, the best way to push through, like, first of all, I played the mirror a couple times.
Oh, God, that sounds a lot of fun.
Yeah, and then I've also played against White Devotion a couple of times. And, like, what was really awkward was that I needed to push my creature through. And I would have normally used the Alcide. Mm-hmm. But if I gave my creature protection from white, all the auras would fall off.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So now you're like, what happens?
Right, yeah, so it sometimes can get really awkward there. Like, or, you know, if your opponent's playing, like, Deckenstone, which is something that happened to me as well.
Yeah, Deckenstone's a nice one right now.
Yeah. I mean, Stasis Snare, things, anything like that. Like, any white removal, it's going to be kind of awkward to save it with your Alisade.
Yeah. I think it's so awkward, but I feel like this deck is real, and it will just have weekends where it's just going to be the right thing, and then it's going to be, like, the right deck you were supposed to play it, and you're going to get paired against, like, Mono White Devotion, which we're going to talk about here in a second. And you're just going to lose, right? And you just got kind of beats, you know, just how things work out.
Yeah, definitely. I think that matchup is awful for what it's worth for this deck.
Well, let's talk about Mono White Devotion, because you keep mentioning it, and it's a deck that I'm kind of lower on, but I know a lot of, like, really great players and people are pretty high on this deck. So what do you think about Mono White Devotion? What are we trying to do with that deck?
So I think that the secret to Mono White Devotion is that you're mostly just playing... It's sort of analogous to the blue-white, what was it called? Just like blue-white tempo from back in, like, Eldritch Moon Standard.
Oh, yeah, like the blue-white flash deck?
Yeah, blue-white flash, yeah. It's sort of similar to that, like, in game plan. Like, you're just going to play a bunch of creatures that kind of accrue a little bit of value, like, you know, Thraben Inspector, Walking Ballista, you got Gideon still. Mm-hmm. Knight of the White Orchids is also a nice pickup for that.
That one's field.
I've also been playing Abyssins out of my sideboard, which have been mostly insane.
Sure, I can buy that for sure.
But yeah, so, I mean, I think that out of the games that I've played, I've only comboed off, like, maybe 10-15% of them. But the threat of being able to combo just makes your opponent have to play awkwardly. You know, it's sort of like the Splinter Twin thing. Like, I think people talk about the Inverter deck as though it's Splinter Twin, but I think this one is a lot closer because... you're a lot more proactive. Like, the Inverter deck just kind of, you know, it has thought ceases to be proactive somewhat. And
it's like
a couple
a
of removal spells, but
deck.
It's a lot more defensive, right? Like, you're trying to basically not let your opponent kill you until you get to your combo. Whereas with the mono white deck, you're kind of pressuring your opponent to where they have to deal with the board. And then by dealing with the board, they're not able to deal with the combo.
Splinter Twin fans will love this. It's like Grixis Twin for Inverter, right? Or like Tarmo Twin for Mono White, right? Like,
sure, yeah.
Similar-ish things happen. Like, the way in which you approach the games are totally different.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember us talking about the Heliod combo back at the SCG Columbus, you know, and I was pretty sure there'd be like a white deck to play. I didn't think it would play out like this per se, but in seeing this deck, I haven't been super impressed. You said you've been playing it some with the Avacyns. Is this a deck that's, like, pretty high up there for you? Like, if you couldn't play Spirits, you'd maybe want to play something like this? And, like, is the big draw that you, like, have, like, a medium beatdown plan with the combo finish? Or, like...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is in my top four decks for for Phoenix.
So what are your top four are Spirits, Inverter, this, and...
and Lotus Breach.
Lotus Breach? Okay. Okay.
So the list that they did the deck tech on at the PT was actually really sweet too, for what it's worth. It's my favorite list so far. It's surprising how many turn four combos you can get. Like, Alisade was another really cool one in that deck. Like, the fact that it has lifelink means that if you play that on one, then play your Heliod on three, and then you can just play a two mana Walking Ballista and then attack with your Alisade. Even if it gets blocked, you're still going to gain the life. Mm-hmm. You can put the counter on the Walking Ballista and then give the Walking Ballista lifelink.
Oh.
Also, Anafenza and Dexus both allow you to go off on turn four. So, that's like, true. if you have either of those on turn two, you can play the Heliod on three, Walking Ballista for two on turn four, and then either you'll gain a life to put the counter on it with Heliod, or you'll bolster onto it with Anafenza.
All right. Yeah, I guess Yeah, I guess when I look at the deck, I like definitely recognize everything you said, but I guess I just didn't process. And I honestly, you know,
this and the idyllic, the idyllic granges as well add another turn four option for you if you just have three planes.
Sure, I was probably biased towards looking at this deck, thinking about it, because I definitely thought of like basically everything you said, but I just didn't process them all at the same time. I probably just let my biases get the best of me on this one. Sure, this deck's probably like way better than I thought it was.
Yeah, it's quite strong, and also like it just generates a lot of advantage too. Like Anafenza just is a totally reasonable creature to play. Dactos has been surprisingly reasonable. You wouldn't think it would be, but like it's kind of just it's unkillable in a lot of ways. Like they can basically only use Fatal Push to kill it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Knight of the White Orchid's been really, really nice, especially because it can go get Idyllic Grange if you know, if that's something you're interested in. Mm-hmm. The Arcanist Owls have been very good too, because they for one turn on Heliod by themselves. And then they also just find most of the cards in the deck.
Yeah, I do love Arcanist Owl, so maybe I'm just maybe that's enough. I do stand that card, so. All right, well.
Yes, I think this deck has a lot going on for it.
Sure, yeah. No, I'm definitely much more interested in that deck. My, like, opinion on the deck went from, like, probably reasonable to, like, actually pretty good. Like, mm-hmm. Right now, like, pretty huge jump there. That's fair. That's something I gotta be careful about, you know, biases and stuff like that. All right, speaking of biases, Chonky Red time. What do you think?
Yeah, that one fell off pretty hard this weekend, huh?
I don't want to give away some information, but someone whose opinion I respect very much, I walked up to them, started talking, and I said, what deck are you playing in Pioneer if you don't mind me sharing, you know? And they're like, nah, it's cool. I'm playing the worst deck in Pioneer. And then they said, can you guess? And I like, you know, I think I actually said Mono White Devotion at the time. Sure. But but they're like, nah, I'm playing Chonky Red. And I was like, and they're like, this is not a good choice. although I think they were playing like some different stuff and they're trying some stuff out. But yeah, the Chonky Red deck seemed like it was like the biggest thing in town. Then everyone realized, oh wait, we can beat Glorybringer. Like that's just doable.
Yeah, well, I think what happened was the format became a lot less mid-range decks and a lot more like, I mean, even the mid-range deck that's currently being played, like Sultai, just goes way over the top of Glorybringer, right? Like, you're playing a bunch of 6/6s and, like, you know, Emrakuls.
Yeah, that's true.
And then, like, every other deck's a combo deck. Like, there's, I mean, between Lotus Breach, Mono White Devotion, Dimir Inverter, like, there's just several decks that will kill you before Glorybringer even matters.
Yeah, well, there is Niptali as well, but we're going to talk about that one here soon enough.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, Nimbus is also another 6/6, right? Like, it's just.
And it's a dragon. Even if it was a 4/4.
Sure. You know? Yeah. You can't even double Glorybringer it.
Yeah. That's a judge right there. Boom. Get him. no, but yeah, the Chonky Red deck, I think it's funny to, like, say what we said, because I think, like, the person I was talking to was definitely exaggerating a little bit. It's definitely not the worst deck in Pioneer. It's just, like, a fine deck or whatever, but it just. The format, it's not in a place right now where you can be playing things like, you know, Karizev into Chainwhirl, into Torbrand, into Glorybringer. Like, even though that sounds strong, that's just probably not good enough on average right now.
I think that you can go the other direction, though, with it. I think that if you drop the Glorybringers and start playing more one drops, it actually gets pretty reasonable again.
Man, I was about to segue you for that. Good job. All right. So you like going low. Like, do you like Abbott type stuff? Do you like Eidolons? Where are we at? What are we thinking?
I think that Eidolon might not trigger often enough in this format. Like, there are still a fair amount of, you know, 4 and 5 drops that are being cast.
Sure, that's fair.
So I'm more into Abbott than that, but, yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, you can go pretty hard in the Wizard stuff if you want that. You can
it Wizards 1 GP Nagoya?
Right.
Along that same line. I mean, it's just mono red burn with blue cards for Curious Obsession, sideboard, and, like, Prowess creatures, so.
Yeah, I haven't seen this list, but I'm sure they're playing, like, Storm Chaser Mage and stuff like that.
Yeah, Storm Chaser, I believe the 3-drop from the Cinderwind from Dominaria. So, like,
sure, you know, Adelise.
Adelise, yeah. And then Curious Obsession, Mystical Dispute in the sideboard, and, like, burn spells. So, like, you know.
Yeah, Curious Obsession's a nice one, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that one, you know, it cantrips, and if it doesn't, they probably lose. Like, if it does more than that, so.
I definitely believe that something like that would have a good inverter matchup as well. Mm-hmm. I know I recently lost to, like, just mono blue tempo, like the Curious Obsession Tempest Shin style of deck.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's something that hasn't really taken full, like, hasn't fully formed right now in Pioneer, which is interesting considering how, like, how many good cards that deck has.
Right.
All right, well, we kind of talked about that. Have you thought about playing, this is something that was kind of going around the house, I'm curious to get your opinion, Eldrazi Red? It's kind of like, it's almost like Chonky, but a little lower to the ground, and you're playing Thought Not Seer and Obligator in order to interact with the inverter pressure point in the format. Then you have like Phyrexidon for like the combo decks and stuff, like Heliod, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea. I definitely think that those interact on a better axis than Glorybringer does right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously, being able to take cards with their from their hand with Thoughtnot Seer is really important. And being able to steal the inverter for the last, like, you know, swing or whatever is also just better than Glorybringer.
Mm-hmm.
I think in practice
it doesn't play out well, but...
What's that?
I think in practice it doesn't play out as well as it sounds.
Yeah, I'm sure it doesn't. And I also wonder what your mana base actually looks like in something like that, because there just aren't that many lands. I guess you could just play, like, infinite pain lands, but, you know.
You play some pain, you play some deserts, you play some mutavolts, and you play, like, you know, a Hanawar Garrison, and then...
Sure. I mean, I would just worry that you would open yourself up to some mana issues with not being able to cast Thought-Not Seer sometimes.
Sure, that's fair. I think part of this, too, is that, like, it's kind of like what we talked about where at the beginning of the show I mentioned how maybe, like, Inverter decks will start playing, like, some Urborgs and Ipnu Riverlets, but then, like, that hurts you against aggressive decks, right? Like, if you're there's just going to be games where you have to keep Ipnu as your island for a couple turns, and you're going to cast your Ops and your Sensors, and it's going to cost you that extra life. And the hopes of winning the mirror match or beating the inverter deck specifically in this case, right? And then it's going to cost you in these matchups. And so you have to decide, like, is that actually worth it? And I'm not sure if adding the stumble in your mono red deck and going a little bigger, which we've kind of decided is a little risky, even though this bigger is much better in that style of matchup, when we think that maybe still going low to the ground has some real strengths to it too. So,
yeah, definitely. I also think that the perception of Thought-Not Seer is a little skewed.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, when Thought-Not Seer first started seeing play, it originally cost, like, you know, it was like a turn two basically all the time.
Sure.
Because we had Eye of Ugin as well as Eldrazi Temple.
Yeah.
And even now, when I think of, Thought-Not Seer, I'm usually, like, thinking about it on turn three with, mm-hmm. like, you know, an Eldrazi Temple or, like, a Noble Hierarch or whatever. When it's a 4-4 for 4, it's often just not good enough. I mean, even taking the card out of their hand, it sometimes can be too slow on turn four, like the card that you wanted to take is already on the board.
Well, we mentioned there's a lot of combo decks, right? Like,
not pressuring them in the same way sometimes, you know?
Yeah, but you still are in the early turns kind of curving a little bit, right? Like, I think that's the idea, is that instead of, you know, going Torbrand Glorybringer, you go Frosson Thought-Not Seer.
Yeah, I mean, I realize that you still are, like, going to be able to play some of the early mono red drops, but I mean, the problem is like even against the inverter deck, let's say, like, if you're on the draw, they can just play inverter on four sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And but, then now your Thought-Not Seer just is a 4-4 facing down a 6-6, and it doesn't really have anything relevant to take.
But it depends a lot on the game state, right? Because if you kill the Thassa's Oracle early, then yeah, the Thought-Not Seer is much worse. But if their plan was play this, flip my deck over, you know, and then like cast Omen, cast Thassa's Oracle and win, you just break that up,
right? Sure, that's true. I mean, it's possible it can be like a gotcha card, but I'm just not sure that it's gonna be harder to get them with it once they start seeing a bunch of your lands right after, like, I don't know, like, it depends on how obvious we have to make it with the mana base, right, that we're playing Eldrazi.
Sure. I for what it's worth, I don't think it's that obvious, right? Like, I think the mono red decks for the most part play Mutavolt and they play the desert anyways, and the Garrison is like probably the biggest tell, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Garrison would be almost a dead giveaway, but, like...
For the case of the Pro Tour...
I just don't think that you're going to get away with five. You're not going to get away... Yeah, that's true. You would just know. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, outside...
Even outside of that, like, I mean, you're just not going to be able to get away with playing five colorless lands, right?
Sure. I mean, it depends on the red card you play, right? It restricts the red cards you have access to. But, like,
I'm saying you're going to have to play more than five colorless lands, right? Like, you're going to have to play... Some other lands other than the four Amunap Runes and the Mutavolt that produce colorless. I mean, you could try to play Sunscorched Desert. But...
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's something you could play. Like, in my mind, you had, like, 11 colorless sources. Because you have four.
What are the other three?
So, Mutavolt, Deserts, that's 8, right?
Uh-huh.
A couple Garrisons, and then I figured there's probably a red land I'm forgetting. Like, there's probably something, sure. like a Pain land or something like that. You can, like...
I mean, yeah, you could always play Battlefield Forger, you know, Shivan... whatever the blue-red one's called.
Yeah. And also, like, depending on how you construct the deck, maybe there's a red X type of deck that, like, Unclaimed Territory is reasonable with. I don't know that for sure. That's just, like, a spitball type thing. Like, that would be stuff I'd be interested in looking at. Because then, if, like... I mean, this is getting a little deep here, but, like, you know, if you had a lot of goblins, you could play like an unclaimed territory type thing. And like,
yeah, I'm looking at it right now, and actually, they're basically all humans.
Sure. Yeah. So like, yeah, if you just had like an unclaimed territory named Human and plays humans and your Eldrazi, and we really just need. Like, I think the trick is that your deck will curve out, and then in some matchups you're going to Thought Not Seer and take, like, the Wrath of God or the Bring to Light or the Niv-Mizzet or the Inverter. And then sometimes they're going to play, like, their Niv-Mizzet or their Inverter, and you're going to play Obligator on turn 5. And you don't need them until the later turns.
Yeah, like, I mean, I certainly think that this could work out like that. I'm just not sure what the incentive is anyway, right? Like, yeah, even if somehow this was good against the Inverter deck... Like, what? Why am I playing this mono red deck instead of playing anything else?
Yeah, the reason is because you like playing mono red, and so you're adapting to the metagame, right?
It's sure.
Like
yeah. Like if this is just your deck that you enjoy and you're trying to figure out how to make it better, that's fine. But I think that it's far enough away from the other decks for me, at least right now, that I'm not trying to reinvent mono red to beat the metagame. I'd rather just play something else in the metagame until mono red, becomes better.
That's fair. I think. While I am talking myself into a bit, I do think it plays out a little worse than it sounds, right? Like, I mentioned that at the top of it, but that is, like, the logic presented. And I don't think it's, like, bad logic and bad theory. I just think that, for me, it is a little bit lower than these other decks, and I just don't believe Mono Red to be that insane at the moment. And if so, I would believe that a lower to the ground, like, 2 CMC and less on average, so, like, you would play Light at the Stage and Bonecrusher Giant in your deck because they are 1 and 2 mana cards most of the time that sometimes have other modes. But like if you play 2 drops and lower only and you just double spell a lot against people and throw burn at their face, I feel like that would probably be a better way to do this same, to attack these same decks and be more efficient in other matchups, right?
Yeah, so. I agree.
Yeah. Well, we spent a lot of time talking about red, didn't expect that to happen. Let's talk about Niv to Lie, the sweetest deck in Pioneer. Next to Inverter, because let's be honest for a second. We talk about Inverter a lot. It's so sick that card's playable. Can we just take 2 seconds? That's awesome. All right.
I honestly, when I saw that card spoiled, I thought it was just going to be playable as just a 4-mana 6/6. I mean, and I've played it that way in the Dimir Inverter deck before. Like, I definitely had a hand where I had just double Inverter or whatever. It's like, you know what? I can just definitely kill them with these before I'm going to deck myself.
Have you ever had the Inverter Thassa kill?
No, I haven't done that.
Oh man, that's a life.
You trying to do it for 10 mana all in one turn?
I've seen it happen. It was a very long game. It involved a dig through time and then a top deck of like the other piece.
Right.
But yeah, it was pretty sick when it happened. It was like tapped out, dead. So that was cool. But Niv to Light. Speaking of cool things going on, we haven't talked about Niv to Light a lot. We haven't mentioned it a lot, and it seems like that isn't like smart on our half. Just to be blunt about it, because PV, Strosky, Ivan Flock, they think it's like one of the best decks in Pioneer right now, according to Twitter. And we saw PV put up a top 4 finish at the Pro Tour. What's going on? Why aren't we talking about this?
I just want to say that PV is great. And it's hard to... It almost makes it harder to take his top 8 seriously as far as like whether I think the deck is good. Because historically, like the last... I don't know if the last few times, but like there have been several times now where I've seen him top 8 a Pro Tour with the deck, and I'm like, oh man, I thought this deck was unplayable. Apparently not. And then like I find out the deck was just unplayable, and he's just a master.
Or he was like good for the weekend, right? Like
beyond that though, like I mean, he's often the only one that has like a good record with these decks.
Sure, but I mean like Ivan and like Strosky, it seems like they didn't have great draft experiences, and that like.
Sure. I mean, they had the actual.
Yeah, I feel like
constructed wins up on
goldfish.
Yeah.
I feel like I heard either Ivan or Strosky like 7-3'd and the other one like 7-2'd or whatever it is. They like got very close to being posted, but didn't, according to Twitter. I could be mistaken.
Oh, so they posted everything down to like, I think they just posted every single deck's wins. So.
Okay. Perfect. Awesome.
But it does not look like, I mean, it looks like there was one person that had 7 wins outside of PV, which I don't know how many constructed wins he has because it's not posted.
Sure.
Okay. Looks like he went 8-2 overall. So yeah, 8-2 in constructed.
Awesome.
But yeah, it looks like, so we got 1 at 7 wins and then.
Well, either way, I think the Niv to Light deck is
6 wins.
Pretty close. Like
I think it's a fine deck. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's bad by any means, but I just don't think that it's, I don't think that it's the most powerful thing you can be doing, and it requires a big cost, right? Like, first of all, you're playing a 5-color mana base, which is sometimes going to have problems. Like, I mean, the mana seems to be working out okay, but sometimes you're going to have problems. And
everyone makes
also
the same joke. It's so good. Sorry, keep going.
You're also kind of playing a commander deck. Like, you're just playing a bunch of one-ofs that kind of work in certain situations.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, it has the problem of just drawing the wrong pieces. Like, you're not the most proactive deck, but you're also not the most inevitable either.
That's
fair. I think that's a really hard spot to be in.
I feel like, and I've had this conversation a bunch, and I've been shot down a bunch, but I haven't been shot down hard enough. Like, I haven't had the death nail hammer or whatever. Like, this hasn't hit me yet. Where I feel like there's a way to build Niv, and mind you, I don't know what it looks like. So, like, part of this is on me. Where you're more green something something based, and then you play Niv and you play cards like Paradise Druid, Caryatid, and Dry to the Illusion Grove, and that's your fixing. And then, like, your Niv draw 3 to 4 cards, and you know, you have a couple bullets, whatever, in your sideboard, like, you know, cards that, like, would be off color, air quote, and maybe some in the main deck. But for the most part, you would just be like a green Niv deck. And I feel like there's a way to do that. And it could just be that given an infinite timeline and all the cards, you could do that and you can't in Pioneer. But I also just haven't had to practice Pioneer. And I don't believe even if I do all of this work, that's going to make the deck so much stronger. Because part of it now is that, like, it can, like, high roll you with all the powerful cards. I just think the deck can become more consistent in a different way. But I don't know how to make that happen. So.
I mean, I could believe that it could be more consistent. The question becomes, what's the payoff, right? Like, the payoff is that I'm casting a 5-mana 6-6 that, I mean, realistically, I think you're really overestimating how many cards Nimbus draws on average. Because even right now, with their nonsense card selection where they're all different guilds and, like, you know, almost every card is multicolored, it's still only, like, 3 to 4 right now.
Sure, yeah, maybe I'm just overestimating how much.
So I think that if you're building it more, like, solidly monocolored, because I know, you know, I've talked about this a little bit, and you were suggesting things like ultimate price, and I think once you start cutting the number of multicolored cards, you're going to probably have a lot of 1 and 2 card Nimbuzzards.
Sure.
And then it just, so I'm playing a 5-mana, 5-color 6-6 that draws me 1 card when I could be playing a 4-mana 6-6 that wins me the game the next turn.
Yeah, I mean, yes, that is part of the problem. I think that's, you know, part of the problem with Niv in general. To be fair, I do think that, like, mentioning the fact it's a 5-color 6-6 is disingenuous when I'm talking about it, like, being base green, because, like, that deck, it would just be quite easy to cast the card.
I mean, maybe. You still need one of every color of mana, right? Like, if there's a card that's hard to cast, it's Nimbuzzit.
I mean, I guess that's fair enough, sure. Maybe I'm overestimating the mana. I don't know. No one's, I'm just gonna, like, drop it until it happens, but
I'm just saying, you're not really making the mana better when you still have a 5-mana 5-colored card, right? Like, if you have mana to cast Nimbuzzit, you have mana to cast everything else.
Sure, but, like, the other cards in your deck would be easier to cast. You just have, like, the accelerants and stuff. It doesn't matter. I can't present a deck that's reasonable, and so as such, like, a lot of this is just theory, and I don't have anything to back it up, so it's all just too nebulous, so we shouldn't even talk about it on the podcast.
Sure.
I just had to get it out there, and, you know,
well, somebody else start working on it and, you know, hit us up with a list.
But, like, do, though. I think we've talked about every deck that I personally wanted to talk about on this week's episode. Are there any other decks that you want to talk about? Do you want to talk about Cats, you know, Mono Green Stompy, 8-Whack, Pummeler? I'm reading decks off Goldfish right now. Like, is there anything else?
I mean, they had... I think
a blue-white control is the one we didn't mention. That's like
Stompy. They had mostly green-black Stompy at the PT, and it looked like the worst performing deck by a pretty huge margin. So probably wouldn't play that.
Sure. What about blue-white control? I mean, like, 5 weeks ago, that was like a real deck in people's minds. Where are we at now?
Blue-white control also had an insanely bad win percentage. I think it was like 25% or something.
Sure. It seems like it would be okay against Inverter until you realize how many discard spells they have, and then they put all the discard spells back in their deck when they...
Oh, yeah.
Inverter.
I mean, I can't even tell you how many times I've had that play pattern come out where, like, they just, you know, you just, like, Thought Seize them, take their counterspell, then play Inverter, get your Thought Seize back, and then Thought Seize them and take their counterspell again so you can cast the other one. It's like, oh, well.
Yeah. Yeah, like, on stream we had a line where, like, we could, like, set up Thought Seize, Thought Erasure, Oracle all in one turn. So it's
right.
Like, you have to have all of it to beat us.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's even pre-board. Like, post-board, they get Mystical Disputes too. And, like, given that they're the ones that, you know, they're the ones that are applying the pressure you know, if you ever lose one engagement, you just lose the game. Whereas they can lose engagements and like continue to play.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, so I guess that does it for it. So right now,
yeah, I haven't been losing to blue white with anything. I would not recommend that.
That's fair. Yeah, I don't think it's in eternal formats. Like, I think it is better than like modern blue white in its respective format right now. But I do think it is hard to be a reactive deck in like the modern era of Magic. Like things like Teferi and like stuff like that. Once they take over, they take over. But the game is so much more about the board these days that like these decks can sometimes just have draws that don't interact that well with it, and then they just fall too far behind, where other decks play to the board even when they do have like kind of stumbly draws. So
right.
I think that matters a lot. Well, that is it, I guess. So you're playing Spirits as of right now. I'm Invertering. That's what's going on. We're going to have all of those information. So after you submit your deck for the Pro Tour, it's going to be up on the Patreon, right? And on the Facebook page?
Or yeah.
On the Facebook group, I should say.
Yeah.
Awesome. And then I'll post my deck list and everything for the Inverter up there as well. Matt, thanks for coming on this week and talking to me about all this kind of stuff. You just spewed all this value. Did you see Canister do it? And you're like, I too could win a Pro Tour if I come on somewhere. So you came to proclaim to the world. You're so open about everything.
Yeah, he's really given up the secret. It's, you just got to go spike a challenge with the deck that you're planning on playing at the Pro Tour the next week. And then, you know, it's going to go well. Yeah.
Easy peasy lemon squeezy. Well, if you want to find Matt, you can follow him on Twitter at The Witch Cling, and you can watch coverage where he's going to be winning it. So you're going to see him on at least for the elimination rounds. and then you can find me at Mason E. Clark on Twitter. Find the show each every week here on the network and on youtube.com/constructedcriticism. And if you want to support the show, greatly appreciated. Go to patreon.com/ccmtg. And now, Kling, I get to talk shop for like a minute, so you get to zone out if you want. I have the new co-host, and everything is going to go forward, but here's the trick. The person who we're not going to talk about who they are right now, they have a lot of stuff going on in life right now, and so they could start doing the podcast now, but it would be super stressful and honestly lead to worse episodes in that time period. And then I lost the bet with Matt, and so I probably owe him some money. So we're just going to leave Matt on the show for a little bit. Let them, you know, go through their things in life. And then starting in April, we're going to have the new co-host come on. So you're going to have some Matt. We're going to have some, you know, episodes with stuff that Matt wants to talk about, you know, like why Thought Seize should be banned. I'm sure we'll do that one this time or something like that. But
oh man, can we finally do the full brainstorm episode?
Do you want to do a brainstorm? I'll do at least a Patreon only episode on a brainstorm. Once again, like I mentioned kind of last week on the show, we're going to figure out the Patreon stuff with that. And so for right now, everything's going to stay the same. You're going to get your tokens. You're going to get your wristbands. I was talking to Spencer about that. All that kind of stuff's going to go out. And then we're going to figure out exactly what we're offering. But from the quick conversation I've had with the person, it doesn't seem like it's going to change very much. So just don't expect big changes. I just wanted to let everyone know, because I kind of left on like a ominous note last week, and I just wanted to mention it here. So thank you everyone so much for listening. Thank you, Matt, for coming on, and we will see you all next week.
See ya.